Welcome to The Afterglow. The Afterglow podcast gives women, we're talking to you, the permission and tools to live life according to your own rules.
Yes, this is a platform to educate and empower women identifying humans through intriguing conversations with courageous Canadian women who are breaking down limiting beliefs and outdated rules. These women have done it, are doing it, or can provide tools for you to do the same.
We are Julie Watson
and Liz Doyle-Hermer.
And we started Afterglow, our yoga studio, after years of staying home to raise kids. Now, as podcasters, we want to help others do the same. Step into your own power. It's time to shake things up and get real about who you are and what you want.
The Afterglow is your next act. It's what came after you did what you were told and instead decided to do what was in your heart. It's how you have reinvented yourself. It's your vision for the next 40 to 50 years. It's when you took your power back.
This episode is sponsored by The Richards Group. Find your home, where you live, dream, and grow. Check them out at www.therichardsgroup.ca. Welcome to The Afterglow. On today's show, we have Dr. Jillian Murphy. Dr. Murphy is a registered naturopathic doctor with a degree in science and kinesiology. She's an educator and coach who offers up the very best help to diverse, smart, health-conscious people who are done with dieting. She helps them get out of their heads and reconnect with their bodies. Jillian uses up-to-date eating psychology, clinical insight, and guidance around diet culture, health, and weight to teach individuals why they stay stuck in negative patterns with food and feel constant body dissatisfaction and how they can make the shift to find food peace and body joy. Jillian has dedicated the past 8 years to studying the psychology of eating, the relationship between weight and health, intuitive eating, and the most in-the-know strategies for exiting the diet cycle. She wants you to find freedom in food and love for your body. She has a blog and podcast called Food Freedom, Body Love. Let's get started.
Are we just diving right in?
Do you want to go? Yeah, let's just do this. Welcome. Welcome to The Afterglow.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, let's dive right in. We'd love to know, you know, what was your childhood like? You know, what were the early messages you received around food? Just take us back to what it was like.
Yeah, well, I'm from the East Coast, so food is very like central. I think like it is in a lot of cultures in different ways. Not being force-fed, but like huge Irish Catholic families, always like way too much food. You know, I would get my grandma to teach me how to bake, and there was never a recipe. It was always like the biggest mixing bowl you can imagine, and like a whole bag of flour and a whole, you know, always like massive quantities. But food is really celebratory. And, you know, I was born in PEI, and then my dad actually did his PhD. They had four kids quite young, and my dad did his PhD at the University of Waterloo. So I lived in Waterloo for a few years before we moved back to the East Coast. And I think during that time, and probably moving back to Fredericton, not all the way back to PEI, food again was even more celebratory because it was a bigger deal when we got together as a big family, like as an insular sort of like immediate family, it was less of a big deal. My mom was one of 12 kids and one of the oldest girls, and like, was not that interested in cooking. She was not very maternal in a lot of ways because she had just been a mom kind of her whole life. So with us, she was much more like not a baker, worst school lunches ever. You know, we laugh about it now, but it was, you know, pretty funny. So we got more of that like celebratory feeling when we got together as family. So just like very celebratory. I felt like my parents had good relationships with food overall. And so I think that for the most part, we didn't get a lot of intense messaging around food. It was also the 80s and the 90s. So like, there was no like clean eating movement, you know, if that makes sense. I had gone to sort of a hippie preschool when I was younger. So I was aware of this like kind of granola-y approach to food. And it always really interested me because we had this cookbook from the preschool and it was part of my like history, but food just wasn't, you know, just wasn't that big of a deal in our house besides the holidays and stuff. I was an athlete. So felt pretty good in my body for the most part. Like I was aware that I was considered sort of like stocky or solid, but didn't really think of that as a bad thing until probably a little bit later. So overall, I feel like it was pretty good growing up, you know, like, I felt like it was just pretty good. It just sort of turned when I was like 19, 20, things started to shift.
So tell us about that, because I know that, you know, particularly teenagehood is like a really big time of being self-conscious and your body's changing and stuff. And you just mentioned that sports was really helpful, right? To feel more athletic and less focused on actually like dieting.
Right, focused on ability versus looks.
Right, which I think is something that we should always think about, you know, promoting to our kids as well, right? Is that it's like feeling strong or feeling healthy, your ability. But there was a little bit of that like low fat, no fat kind of culture then, right?
And Snackwell's cookies.
Snackwell's cookies. Yeah. I know you get the little packages and like calorie, whatever.
And dieting was really overt as well, right? Like it's gone. It's really, we could get into sort of like the evolution of dieting, but at that point in time, it was still really overt. Like it was still like, it's a little covert now where it's almost like a little bit gauche or like socially unacceptable, or like there's a weird feel to dieting where I think there's a huge diet industry where people are still very into it, but I feel like in my world anyway, there's this evolution towards just healthy eating or like clean eating. I'm putting it in quotation marks when it's really dieting, you know?
Right. Whereas moms used to use the word diet.
I'm dieting. Like I'm doing the cabbage soup diet. I'm this diet. I'm that diet. You know, it was very like, it was a diet centric world, and it was a lot of low fat diet foods were really big. I always say that it's like, you know, we swim in diet culture. It's like we're fish swimming in the ocean of diet culture. And so it's actually all around us all the time. And I can remember, you know, if I had to look back, I have some very distinct memories of comments about my body or food. But I always say that it's really interesting how there's specific moments where diet culture goes from being like something around us that we're aware of to something that we internalize as an issue with us. Mm-hmm. Like it becomes something where we're all of a sudden, I'm a problem, and diet culture is like offering a solution. It's making me a problem, but it's also offering a solution. And so for whatever reason, even though I was clearly aware of it. It was around me. It was in movies. I mean, every movie I talk about, like the big formative movies for me growing up were all like kind of not makeover, but like coming of age stories where the girl like exercised and lost weight and got pretty and then got a life, basically. Mm-hmm. So it was all around. My mom was a big exerciser. So there was some interesting messaging there. I just wasn't internalizing it so much about me. And for me, when that point was, luckily it was a little bit later in my life, but it was 19. And I had been a soccer player my whole life. And so, you know, real value on being strong and sturdy and doing lots of different kinds of movement. And for a number of different reasons, I switched from university soccer to the cross country team. So over the course of a couple of years, there were some things that went on and I was like, you know what, I think this is the route I'm going to go. And in the process of putting, you know, more mileage in versus cross training, and then also simultaneously finding naturopathic medicine, going back to those granola roots that I was interested in from preschool, getting really interested in like nutrition and food. And again, way ahead of the clean eating movement. Like nobody knew what a trans fat was. It was still in everything. Nobody cared about sugar, right? Like it was, people just thought I was like weird and kind of wacky, and it became part of my identity actually to be like obsessed with sort of healthy food. So these two things happening simultaneously led to me losing some weight. And I was a really medium-sized girl who was fit. And so, I mean, I won't use numbers, but like it wasn't that much weight, but it went from like zero attention to a lot of attention. Mm. Girls, boys, all of the above. And like, we're so proud of you. Like that's an interesting message that I really remember. And it's really kind of messed up, right? And so it just started to pull up all these feelings of like, oh my God, what did I look like before? I felt pretty good about myself, but obviously I was some sort of monster I didn't realize, you know, because people stopping me in bars, people stopping me on the road, out, you know, outside the gym at school. And so it became kind of like, I didn't notice it, but it was like this anxiety started to grow about like going backward. And what that anxiety fueled was more and more intensity and intention around exercise and food. So more and more and more and more until, you know, all of a sudden I got too thin, and then the compliments really quickly stopped again, and it became really negative feedback. So it was tough because it was, I was always eating. I wasn't purging, unless you count exercise probably as purging. So I didn't really fit into the eating disorder. Like, I knew I didn't want to live like that. It felt really uncomfortable for me really quickly, because I just like food and I like people and I like going out, and it was getting in the way of fun. Like, I just want to have fun, you know? And so I knew pretty early on that it was a problem, although I would have denied it probably to anybody around me. And so I, on my own, sought out, you know, a family doctor who was like, you know, an old white guy who was like, you're fine, you're just super healthy and fit. And I was like, but, you know, please take this seriously. And it was like, you know, no, you're good, you're fine. Mm-hmm. And I went to an eating disorder clinic, but I didn't fit. I didn't like tick all the right boxes, so I didn't qualify for treatment. So I just had to sort of work my way out of it. And it was tough because I was working my way out of it while also then getting into naturopathic school, like doing the hard work to get in. So things were kind of intense, and then getting in and getting into a program where we talked about food all the time.
I mean, one of the things I'm hearing is just, you know, the level of effort and exhaustion it takes to maintain the fitting in, you know, the watching your food and the exercising. And then when you do it, it's like, yay, you did it. But you're exhausted, right? You're exhausted from all that energy it takes to just fit into it and to achieve and to succeed in that. And so it's amazing that you were able to, at a very early age, say, I'm getting, you know, praise for this, but this doesn't feel good to me.
Yeah, I'm really thankful for it, because, you know, people can lose decades of their life. And I did in some ways, but not in the intense way that other people go through this, right? And I know that my parents had an experience with a family friend when they were younger who had died of an eating disorder. And so it pulled up a lot of anxiety for them. But I was just like, you have to trust me here. I don't want to live like this. So like, I don't know quite how to get myself out of this, but I'm working on it. Like, this isn't how I want to live my life. I'm not interested in this. And I would say too, that the most formative thing, like the first time somebody could actually verbalize for me what was going on, and it was really game changing and formative, was my running coach, actually, who's just super amazing. And he sort of said, he just sat me down and said, listen, there is nothing healthy about being obsessed with health. Mm-hmm. And it was like the first time I was like, oh my God, that's it. And again, it was orthorexia. There was just no word for it, you know, back then.
Yeah. Can you tell us what orthorexia is? Because you posted on your Instagram that 50% of actual like nutritionists are
at risk.
Potentially at risk for being orthorexia, and about 12 to 13% potentially have an eating disorder. And so what's the difference between orthorexia versus something like anorexia, bulimia? Because I'd never heard of orthorexia until probably like, you know, within the last 5 years. It just didn't exist when we were growing up.
Yeah, the word was coined in 1997. And you know what's interesting is, I do believe, because I was doing a lot of research in books, because there wasn't a lot of internet, like dating myself really majorly right now. But like, I do remember seeing that word somewhere, probably in my early 20s. And I believe it was coined in 1997. It's just not totally accepted by the medical community, becoming more accepted, but it's because these things all bleed together so much. And so anorexia and orthorexia can bleed into one another, and they can both coexist. But the main difference is that the obsession is mostly with the cleanliness of your food. So it's an anxiety, typically driven obsession with the healthiness of food. And so it can look very socially acceptable until it becomes so restrictive that, like I said, you lose so much weight. Like, it almost bleeds into anorexia, because it becomes so restrictive that I became so thin because there were so few foods that were acceptable or okay. but I was always eating, if that makes sense. So not trying to sort of not eat or not trying to eat as little as possible. It was mostly just the cleanliness was the big factor. And then of course, absolutely, they bleed together, but you can 100% have orthorexia without going down that too restrictive route. So you could stay in a route that looks kind of socially acceptable while experiencing the exhaustion that Liz was talking about, right? Like that complete mental, emotional, physical preoccupation that's very like compulsive and obsessive. It bleeds into OCD as well, where it's just this, you're on a loop about your food and if it's healthy enough and good enough. And obviously as the clean eating movement has grown, you know, you can basically find information anywhere to tell you that almost anything is not good for you.
Yeah. I was going to say, do you think that orthorexia has grown in not popularity, but you know, with people because there's so much messaging now out there about what's toxic, what are the toxins in our food, sugar is bad, you know, all of that stuff. So now people are really going to that place of restrictive eating.
Yeah, absolutely. And along a spectrum from like more socially acceptable to less socially acceptable, right? So there's different iterations of it, but I think absolutely. And the more morality is attached to food. So again, going back to like the 80s and 90s, you know, there was problems like the dieting and the diet culture was so overt and so many issues with that, but there wasn't so much morality around food. Like I find it interesting. My kids wanted to watch ET maybe a year ago or a year and a half ago. And just the kids eating, like the kids drinking Cokes or Pepsis. I just don't feel like we would ever see that in a movie today. Cause it's like, you know, I've literally seen holistic nutritionists, you know, not against them because naturopaths do it, dietitians do it, but like make posts around Halloween that's like allowing your children to eat sugar is child abuse. So it's like to go from, you know, a formative childhood movie that feels so wholesome to like somebody basically accusing you, which is, I believe, nonsense, by the way. I think that that's wild and wildly inappropriate when it comes to food and really like all the isms when it comes to like classism and ableism and racism. Just there's so many issues with that kind of a statement. So I want to make sure I'm clear that I'm not buying into it, but like that definitely fuels, like that kind of morality fuels orthorexia because it's Ellen Satter calls it virtue signaling, right? And it becomes like, I use food to signify or to signal how good of a person I am. And the more it becomes like an identity, the harder it is to separate yourself from it.
Well, and I can speak to that. And I think Julie too, you had the same experience where IBS or some kind of gastrointestinal thing requiring you to, you know, clean out some certain foods. And then that becoming this obsessive compulsive thing, like just an extending and cutting out more and more and, you know, then it not being healthy anymore. And I have certainly experienced that, but I'd love you just to lay out, you know, the diet industrial complex, because I think some people might not actually be familiar with what that is and how it's affecting them. So how would you just tell someone who is like, they're swimming in this water, but not realizing it?
Right.
What would you say to them?
So I would say that it's this 60 plus, I think it's actually probably double at this point. I think I read somewhere recently, it's more like 120, but like, let's say 60 plus billion dollar industry that essentially has convinced us that our bodies are wrong. So it is fueled and or taken advantage of some of the misinformation about bodies and weight and health. And it's used that to fuel this belief that our bodies are wrong. And the way for us to make our bodies right is through dieting and food restriction and food control to get to a specific kind of body. And part of the, you know, there's many myths within that, but one of the biggest myths is that weight is inherently within our individual control long-term, and that maintenance is easy if we can just get there, and that the perfect body, quote unquote, is available to everyone if we work hard enough, and that a very, very special life is promised if you get there. If you work hard enough and you sacrifice enough and you get that body, which again, should be fairly easy to get if you just find the right plan and you could actually stick to it. If you get there, you're going to be happier. You're going to never be judged again by the people around you. You're going to live forever. you're going to have lots of money and success and love and all those things. And the tricky part is that the belief system is so deeply entrenched in our culture that some of those things are true, that, you know, so we do get social privilege from having a very specific kind of body. The problem is how much people are sacrificing, and how few people are actually able to get there. And so many people are just, you know, literally giving away decades of their life trying to get to a body that, I mean, that's never, was never meant to be theirs.
Even in the book, The Burnout, which Julie got me onto, which we really love, by the Nagoski sisters. And she talks about the same thing. She calls it the bikini industrial complex. But she's very honest in her book saying that, you know, I tell people about the bikini industrial complex, but for this speech, I am actually trying to lose weight because I know it'll go over better if I show up and I'm of a certain size, you know, and she's aware of the conflict. And so is that part of what you would recommend? Like just to kind of acknowledge that this exists first and foremost?
I think it's such a big deal. You know, I have occasionally at points in time in my work, had people say, why can't you just support women and let them do whatever they want to do? And I always say, if you don't know that you have a different option, if you think that your only way to be happy and healthy and successful and have a good life is to be in a really small body, then you're not making a choice. So I can't support your choices while you are literally being like brainwashed into doing something that is bad for you. Now, if you want to take a look at the whole, like I do this work with women all the time. If you want to take a look at what you're doing and the negative consequences of what you're doing and do some risk assessment and figure out what the trade-off is and what's worth it and what's not worth it. And there occasionally are moments where women give in to the pressures around their body because they just feel like they have to. But at least if someone's going in with their eyes open and realizing that like me restricting food to fit into XY dress to be on a stage is kind of a myth to begin with, but I'm having a hard time buying out of it. And B, if they start binge eating, or if they start being preoccupied with food, or if they start emotionally eating more, or they start doing all of these negative behaviors, if you understand that that is 100% born out of the restriction you were doing versus I'm broken, I have no willpower, I'm a sugar addict, like there's a difference there. There's some agency there. If you know what the potential consequences are for you going in, if that makes sense. So I think like, yeah, if women know all their options and they know why they're doing what they're doing and they're fully aware, then, you know, we're all adults. And for sure, you know, I'm a white, straight, I guess you're taking a video of this so people can see, but like straight, cisgendered, able-bodied, medium-sized woman, it's like not, don't get me wrong, there's been some work to make peace with my body. I still have to do it all the time, but it's like not so radical. And there are other groups of individuals for whom it is more radical and for whom, you know, being in a slightly smaller body may afford them the privileges that they need to get through the world in a way that I don't need them. So I try to be really cautious about like ever judging decisions as long as people really understand all their options and the consequences and side effects of those options, right?
I know that you're saying like, if we could have the awareness of it and then make the decisions from there. But I think that most of us aren't even really aware of, you know, even if I'm sitting here thinking, oh, this is a really interesting conversation. Oh, I'm going to think differently about, but I'm not even aware about the wording that's used, the messaging that's out there, like things that sound really positive, like, you know, managing your eating or
moderation.
Yeah. Or like, you know, have balance for things and that kind of stuff. Like, you know, you've said that those are like co-opted diet industry words to make us believe, but yet still it's highly unattainable because what happens is we are all striving for this perfect, like perfect body, perfect marriage, perfect life, perfect job, perfect, right? It's this, our society thinks or has conditioned us to believe that there is some perfect world out there. And within the body diet industry, it's like you're going to try and achieve it, but because it is actually unattainable, the messages they're sending to us about this perfection, they're just making more money while we're still kind of grappling and grasping at straws trying to get there, right? So what can we say? Like, how do we educate women about what's actually being messaged? What, you know?
Yeah. Well, so what you're identifying. So first of all, when I say like, when people know their options, I feel like most women have to do an enormous amount of work to untangle weight and health, mm-hmm. to untangle body and beauty beliefs, right? Like, I think that it's not as simple, just as simple, like, oh, this is an issue. I think like most people know it's an issue, but I think that you're right. Like, where it gets messy is where the diet industry has gone covert, where there's so many actual dieting behaviors that look on the surface like I'm just taking care of myself. And it's like, are you though? If you're cycling every day between restriction and overeating and, you know, losing control on weekends or nights or whatever that looks like, is that really healthy, you know, for you? Is that actually a good option? So I would agree with you. And I think there have been people who followed me for years who, you know, it always surprises me what pops up, but this programming is so deep and it's like so long standing and it's so socially acceptable that it is very difficult to separate control messaging from trust-based messaging. So that's often what I'm trying to teach, right? So control messaging is messaging that's basically like your brain has information or needs more information, and your brain should be making all of the decisions about what is right for you when it comes to managing your body. And trust-based decisions are much more about tuning into your body and making sure that you're in touch with what your body is asking for. And this is important because most of the information that our brains are currently getting are filled with diet culture beliefs. So for instance, women are taught that they need way less food than most women actually need. They're taught that they need much fewer carbohydrates than they actually need. And so women will think, no, I don't understand why I'm still reactively eating at night or on the weekends, because I'm eating enough. I'm eating all day. And then I'll look at their food and I'll go, this is not enough food. Clearly, because you're being reactive, but also probably not enough carbohydrate or not enough variety, or there's, you know, I mean, I could talk about it for days, but this idea of like, our brains are filled with diet information about what moderation is and what balance is and what health is. And so when our brains are trying to make decisions without consulting with our body or listening to our bodies, we end up falling into old traps. Whereas the work that I do is, how do we reconnect with those internal regulators? How do we turn down the noise of all the food rules and diet rules that we've absorbed all over the years, so that we can get back in touch with what's actually right for us and what our body needs, which could be wildly different from what the woman next to us needs. And then long-term, ultimately, the goal is to be able to take in some nutritional information and consider what's right for us and marry that, or like pair that with body knowing. But the reality is that most of us are very cut off from our bodies, meaning like hunger is just a bad thing, something to be ignored and over, you know, if we have headaches, if we have low blood sugar dips, if we have, you know, if it's in the interest of managing our weight, we're willing to ignore all of that in order to follow the rules in our head.
Yeah. I think ignoring signs of hunger and ignoring signs of satiation too. I've definitely done both those things. And, you know, when I hear of trust-based approach, I'm imagining that's the intuitive eating, and it's really about slowing down, which works against our culture, right? Yeah. You know, tuning to the neck down, which works against our culture, as you've said, and just, you know, so I'd love to learn more about intuitive eating, like checking in with ourselves. Am I hungry? You know, what do I need?
I use two different trust-based eating models in my work. I use intuitive eating, which is a research-validated model developed by Evelyn Triboli and Elise Reich. And I use Ellen Satter's competent eating model, which is also a trust-based eating model. And the main difference between the two, both of them are the primary goal is to get back in touch with internal regulators, which are hunger, fullness. And I love that you mentioned satiation, because that is the one that is often forgotten. Like, very quickly, trust-based eating becomes the hungerful diet, right? Where people think that, you know, so satiation is important, because satiation is like, not just when you're full, but when you actually feel done, like you feel satisfied, food was pleasurable and enjoyable. The way Ellen Satter talks about satiation is allowing yourself to choose food that you really enjoy and enjoy the food you choose, which is challenging.
That feels liberating. Like right there, that's like my face is smiling.
I get goosebumps. I
want to eat right now because of it.
That's allowed.
But it's really tough when someone, especially I'm starting a program with practitioners and professionals who are already doing this work, but looking to go deeper or wanting to start this work. And especially if you've been through a naturopathic program or a dietitian program or a holistic nutrition program, it's very difficult when to come to the realization that you might actually just enjoy cookies, you know, because you've been maybe trained to believe that food is just fuel through some of these programs and it should be infinitely controllable and pleasure's a side piece as opposed to a really integral part of eating that actually helps us absorb nutrients and regulate appetite. Like it's imperative.
Just two things that you just said. So the pleasure part of it is something that we also in our culture, particularly as women, condition ourselves away from, right? We only get pleasure as a treat if XYZ is done,
right?
But also we don't prioritize our pleasure in general.
Right.
And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that this morning I said to my kids, if I was intuitive eating right now, I would eat chocolate cake for breakfast. And so my daughter was like, eat the chocolate cake for breakfast. So I want to know how you differentiate, you know, the craving or satiation from just like, I need a sugar high or, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, the first thing I'll say is that eating isn't perfect. It never is. Normal eating is not perfect. Normal eating, I won't say a swear word. We F up all the time. We make mistakes all the time, just like we do with anything. Like I often, like the analogy I use is like driving a car. Like we don't drive in a perfectly straight line. We like go this way a little far and then we go this way a little far and we go this way a little far. Dieting, restriction, interestingly, it's like we're jerking the car from one side to the other where we're like, no sugar whatsoever, all the sugar all night long. And so intuitive eating is about settling that down so that it's a much smoother ride, but that doesn't mean it's perfect, right? So occasionally we make mistakes, but what does happen, and I will say that the process to smoothing out that ride can be a little messy because it doesn't happen overnight that you go from having restrictive weight loss fueled motivated thought processes to being totally trusting of your body. It's a process that I have to take people through. But as women and men, I've worked with men too, and non-binary individuals. I work mostly with women. So I always use that word, but like all people can benefit from this work and children. But as I work women through the process, you know, they slowly get better and better in touch. So I'll just use myself as an example. You know, using personal examples are not always great, but like, I thought that even when I worked myself out of the worst of the orthorexia, you know, I was reading a lot of Jeanine Roth at the time, who's an eating disorder writer, really one of the foundational writers of this work, but her work was still very steeped in like, you know, once you make peace with food, you're just going to eat exactly right and your body, you'll lose weight. So there was still like this little interesting piece of control within her messaging. And so for me, what that fueled was an ongoing feeling that like, well, I hadn't quite gotten there because my body wasn't exactly right. So I kept micro controlling food and it just continued to fuel this belief that I was a bit of a sugar addict and my appetite was just bigger than everybody's. And I was a little broken around food. Like I would always be an emotional eater. I would always be a sugar addict. And when I had my second baby, I had gained weight and I couldn't take it off. And I'm a naturopath. So I did all the things. I did all the functional tests. I did all the bioidentical hormones. I did all the supplements, all the things. I was on all the plans. And that was when I really cut my losses. I was like, I started to go down that obsessive hole again. And so instead of going down that obsessive hole anymore, because I knew I didn't want to go that way, I hired a body image coach. And she was like, you know, she really clearly laid out this health at every size and, you know, basically your body is fine. And it's really interesting. The moment that you start to accept your body, not that it's easy, but the moment that you start to accept your body and work with your body, there stops being this like fueling reactive, rebellious decisions with food. Because I was kind of either, it was like a micro level, but I was still like kind of trying to control all the time. And then I would be rebellious and reactive. And so as I work women through this process, as I worked through the process myself, there's less and less to react to. There's less and less to be rebellious against. And so does that mean that I never crave chocolate cake for breakfast? No, occasionally I do. But I have gotten to know myself, and genuinely, not from a should place, I genuinely know how I feel when I eat chocolate cake for breakfast, and that's not how I want to feel most days. So most days I make an internal decision. I could eat chocolate cake. There's always sugar in our house. I could eat whatever I want, but most days I choose not to, not because I shouldn't, because I don't really want it.
I just want to emphasize what you just said about your path and then getting this body image coach, because I did read that what happened for you is you did go into it and then still think, okay, if I do these things, then the weight will come off and then I'll have that body. Oh, and yeah. Then, yeah. So then it was like a process of multiple times kind of going, okay, all right, I'll follow these guidelines because then the weight will come off. And so it was really still this body image issue, again, like an indication that we are so conditioned into wanting to have this type of body as well, regardless of what the eating or the path or whatever, that you had to like condition yourself out of. So can you talk a little bit about that whole, like your own body image and how do you actually get to that place? You've said like, you know, deep body healing, deep body connection in order to get to that place. I'm like at the place where you're at, where I'm like, okay, I can do like body acceptance. I love myself and whatever. But then still when I put on those jeans, it's like, like that doesn't fit right. Maybe I should have not had the chocolate cake, right? Whereas what you're saying is getting to that place of really having that acceptance about what your body is doing for you in this time based on your own choices and intuitive eating. And so it's really like a psychological thing. So you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, the end point is like not really ever an end point, is the reality. Okay. It's a process, right? And we live in a world that genuinely does. Like, I feel really good about my body. I like who I am. I don't get a whole lot of compliments at 41 in an apple shaped body. I don't get a
lot
of
like, awesome. We think you're awesome.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, like, but you know what I'm saying? Like you can clearly remember those days where like, even when I was way underweight, getting literally stopped on the road by like middle-aged men when I was 20, being like, you're so fit, you're so healthy. And I think I'm 100 times healthier right now than I was, but nobody's like, oh my God, Jill, you exercise all the time. You take such good care of yourself. Nobody. So to be clear, it's a process, because we live in a world that really validated my body and my behaviors when I was ill. And now currently, you know, I have a lovely husband. Again, I feel good. No pity party here, right? But like, I don't get a lot of compliments about how I look. I can't remember the last time somebody said, you look great today. It just doesn't happen. So there's this realization that the work is strengthening ourselves and developing a toolkit for managing the fact that we live in a world that values and rewards thinner, smaller, able, white, quite frankly, bodies. And so part of the work is, for me and for the women that I work with, quite fueling, is understanding these systems that are involved, like these systems of oppression, and understanding where I fall. Sonia Renee Taylor calls it like the ladder, right? And understanding where I fall on the ladder. And people are not often ready for this very early in the work, but later in the work, when they get outside of their own kind of bubble of how they feel about their body, to be able to see like, okay, I don't have the thinness privilege, and that sucks, and that makes me feel bad sometimes, but I have a lot of other privileges that I was just born with that I didn't earn, that have gotten me lots of places in life. And so how can I have gratitude? How can I like use the privileges that I have for good? And how can I work to get okay with this one privilege that I don't seem to have? And again, on the spectrum, I'm still somewhere in the middle. So I'm aware that like, as size increases, privilege decreases. But I think for me, it's been a process of recognizing the privileges that I do have, while also getting very deeply honest with myself about the trade-off if I continue to go down that diet route, and realizing like over and over and over again, what I want most is to enjoy the life that I'm having. And it's just, are there moments where like, I wish I didn't have a belly and I could wear jeans? Yeah. Are there moments where like, I catch a glimpse of myself and I'm like, ugh, I'm like this far off the cultural ideal, you know? I remember when I was only this far off, but right now I'm this far off, you know? Yeah, I have those. But the work to me is about, can we separate ourselves from that? Can we understand where it's coming from? Can it be, like I liken it sometimes to almost like a bad hair day. Like I can have bad hair days, but I don't turn it into like, I have no value. I have no worth. I shouldn't be doing the work I'm doing. I need to punish myself for this. It, you know, it's not a perfect analogy, but just that idea of like, I'm less invested. It's less serious. It holds less, you know, no pun intended, weight. It's just a thought I have, and I can separate myself from it and go, that's a natural reaction to the world that we live in. But like, what kind of day do I want to have today?
I love that. It's just a thought. I don't have to conform to that thought.
Yeah. And again, some days are harder than others. Some moments, it's mostly now, I would say, it doesn't affect me so much, but there was lots of steps along the way, like you said, and most women do come into the work. And if they're being honest, are like, I'm just really hoping that I'll intuitively eat and then lose weight. And that's okay. You know, as long as they understand what I do and I don't promise weight loss, I'm happy to take that on because that's where I was when I started. But there are just moments now. So along the way, there was lots of iterations or lots of steps where like, I would fall into a pit about my body for like 2 weeks or a month. And then it was like 3 or 4 days. And now it's like moments. It's like an hour. It's before a big event. It's before seeing people I haven't seen in a long time. And again, I just, what is actually going on here? Right. I want to show up a certain way. I feel like my body is a barrier to that. Am I likely to be more successful at dieting my body or at just figuring out how to show up how I want to show up? Right. Showing up how I want to show up. How do I focus on that? So it's just this ongoing process, but it really does require that really heavy work, I think, of deprogramming early on, because it's really hard when you're still buying in to the myths of diet
and
culture.
And buying in, like you said, because you're being rewarded for buying in, right? You're rewarded for having a thin body. And, you know, I think of like workaholic, you know, overachieving culture too. It's the same thing, right? Keep striving, pushing, you know, achieving more, pushing yourself beyond, you know, beyond sleep, beyond normal sleep requirements so you can achieve. It's in a couple of different places we're being influenced by that. I just want to make sure we cover off the basics of your model. You touched about trust-based approaches.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about intuitive eating, but could you-
The other one? Yeah. So the main difference between the two, with intuitive eating, you're basically encouraged to be in touch with your internal regulators 24/7, all day and night. You know, if you're hungry, eat. If you're not, don't. The competent eating model, Ellen Satter's model, has a little bit more structure built into it. So she encourages regular meals and snack times, and then all the permission at those meals and snack times. And it's useful for anyone or everyone, but what I find where I use them differently is Ellen Satter's model is particularly helpful with children who aren't developmentally ready to just have open access to cupboards. Yeah, it's really great for people who are too far out of touch with their internal regulators. So they're a little too far down that eating disorder route where their regulators aren't trustworthy at the moment. It's really helpful for neurodiverse individuals. So like ADHD or autism spectrum disorder, like situations where people are maybe not as connected to those internal regulators just because of how their brains work. And so it's sort of like having this like flexible structure within which you're able to still have permission while making sure that you're being fed regularly and reliably. And also, it's a great model for just some people whose brains love structure, right? Some people just don't do well without any parameters. They have a hard time. The intuitive eating is fantastic for people who are just really high functioning, lots of access, few barriers, and they've just had too many food rules and diet rules applied to them their whole life. And you know what? It's like, this is what you need. You need no rules. And any kind of structure or rule seems to trigger that reactivity and rebelliousness. Like it makes them feel like they're going back on a diet somehow.
Can we talk about kids for a second then?
Yeah.
With, you know, how do we sort of plant the seeds Obviously, we can't just protect them from all the messaging that's already out there, but within our own homes, within our own families, what are some really good places to start with our kids to get them feeling a body positive, but knowing, you know, that food is fuel, food is like you said, like a nice social celebration thing that doesn't have to be about rewarding ourselves and like doing it in a more positive way.
So the first thing I think is talking about it, because a lot of people will say sort of like the old, it's not the same, but like a little bit parallel to like the old thoughts around racism, where it's like, we're not racist. We don't see color. We just don't talk about it. And it's like, no, there are different rules that apply to different people and there are systems of power and structure. And like, if we ignore them, it doesn't make them go away. Like talking about it is what helps people understand what's going on and like helping us unveil the biases that we have. Mm-hmm. And I feel like similarly, pretending that you don't care about bodies or you don't notice bodies or you don't think about bodies does a lot of disservice, because kids can see the difference in bodies and they hear this messaging at the doctor's office. They hear it at their sports groups. They hear it at school. Kids police each other now more than ever when it comes to food because of the messaging that they're hearing in their homes. And so I think it's a priority to actually talk about it. This is the way our culture views bodies. Here's the way we feel as a family, you know, while also laying the groundwork for them to understand, especially young kids, like we don't talk about other people's bodies outside of our family unit, because, you know, it's one thing to say, to be fat positive and body positive at home, but we know that the world out there doesn't necessarily reflect that. And kids can, you know, make comments about people's bodies with the best of intentions. So I think talking about it and bringing it to light, and like, I find it really helpful to point it out in kids' movies and books and like old, we sometimes read old classic books with the girls. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, did you hear what they just said? And they notice now. So they're picking it out and also pointing out how it applies differently between, it's changing, but like, it does apply differently between boys and girls and men and women. And like, do you see how there's pressure here, but not pressure there? And pointing out all of the issues basically with the body and the weight and the beauty story. So I think first of all, talking about it and like really laying it out there in age appropriate ways as they grow. And then the second thing is, interestingly, when it comes to nutrition, the advice is when they're very young is we don't have to do a lot of teaching with words. We just do it by modeling. And we do that by just prioritizing eating and sitting down to eat with them and putting a variety of food on the table and allowing them to choose what to eat and how much to eat and allowing them to trust their bodies within that structure of meals, right? So early on, you know, ideally you're just modeling enjoyable eating, and you as a parent within this model, I mean, it would take a while for me to sort of explain the full thing, but within Ellen Satter's division of responsibility, parents are responsible for the food choices. So you're modeling and you're teaching what dinner foods are by picking the foods and making dinner or ordering in or whatever it is that your family does and taking time to sit down and eat the food together. And as long as you're mixing in a healthy variety of foods and forbidden foods, as Ellen Satter calls them, and you're kind of neutrally and joyfully including a wide range of foods, kids grow over time to eat the way that their parents do. But it can take a whole childhood. It can take 18 years, 19 years, 20 years. I mean, I think all of us can think about foods that we didn't eat ever growing up. And we started eating when we were like 24, you know, tomatoes for me.
And what if our kids are older and we planted some seeds that are not, you know, super healthy?
Yeah.
You know, how can we, are there, do you have any tips on terms of how we can correct that? You know, pull out the weeds that need to be pulled out?
I think the first thing is, again, just identifying it. Like, this is how I was taught to think about food. I was taught to believe that we needed to do X, Y, Z. And I'm now seeing that there's some like problems with that storyline. And like, the other thing I'll say is I love asking kids of all ages just lots of questions. So, you know, what do you remember learning about food growing up? Like, what have you absorbed about bodies and weight and health? And then, especially if they're young adults, like that teen, you know, early 20s age, they are very fueled by the political and social movement behind health at every size and intuitive eating. Like when they understand, the issues with some of the current health and wellness industry messaging and diet culture messaging, it's very fueling. Like it, you know, they're really primed right now to want to fight back against these systems of like injustice. So that is very fueling for kids of that age. And then, we always do talk about, you know, with an intuitive eating and also competent eating, gentle nutrition. So there's ways to incorporate, gentle nutrition messaging when kids are older. I just typically recommend that we start with lots of add-in strategies. So the idea that it's a lot easier to add in things that are healthy than to stop or control or restrict things that we consider to be unhealthy. And it's great for two reasons. One, because it's true, it is hard. And two, because the thing that we might be judging as unhealthy might not actually be that unhealthy for us, right? Mm-hmm. So it sort of frees us up from accidentally falling back into old pits. If we're like, you know, these are foods that are more nutrient dense. And these are foods that round out our food experience by being pleasurable and fun and exciting. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. I think that you're right. Like kids, especially now with like, you know, Instagram and all that stuff, like everybody's kind of like their own little social activist. And actually my daughter said something the other day about, you know, fat, whatever. And I was like, you know, that's not a nice word to say. And she was like, Mommy, that was like back in your day when fat was considered to be something bad. Now it's like fat positivity and you can use the word fat. And to me, that felt like so abrasive. But when I think about it and other words that you might use, like overweight or heavier, that makes you, it's like we've defined what is the essential proper weight, what the norm is. And so tell us about how like the word fat and other words that are acceptable now to use versus,
yeah,
you know.
There has been a reclamation on that word for sure. I personally, as like a medium-sized person, I tried it on for size. I feel more comfortable just saying larger bodied because I think that like the real reclamation, that decision is for people who are in bodies that would be more defined as fat versus me deciding that I can use that word because it is still, but I agree with her. I think that what she's saying is true. Like there is a movement to reclaim that word as a neutral descriptive word. Like it's just a body tissue. So I think that that's true. I personally just use larger body, but you're also correct that using words like overweight, like over what weight, if we understand that BMI is inherently inaccurate and that it's way too low than is what, you know, natural for most of the population. And like over what weight, mm-hmm. if that person is sitting, I mean, I'm not sure, but like if that person is sitting stable at a weight, like I, for instance, would fall into like overweight, but even into the obese category based on BMI. And I exercise every day and I eat really well. Like this is just my body. So I'm not over any weight. I'm at my perfect weight, mm-hmm. but according to BMI. So you're right. It inadvertently pathologizes bodies that aren't ill mm-hmm. and aren't sick, right? Which is the problem right now with BMI. So I just use that word larger bodied. I love when people are using the word fat, if they're reclaiming it for themselves. I think that that's great. I did a similar thing when my girls were like quite young. I have two girls, two totally different body types. And the older one who's very wiry sort of said to my plumper, rounder child, like, oh, Pippa, you're so fat and cute. And I was like, she's not fat. You know, I did that immediate, like, and then I was like, oh, wait a minute. In saying that, I automatically made fat a bad thing.
Right.
And it's not. That's her body. And her body is different. And her body does have more fat on it. So we talked it out. Sorry, guys. That was a weird thing for me to say. Your bodies are different, you know, but just remember that we don't make comments on other people's bodies outside of our family. We want to talk about bodies just because at that time they were like 1 and 3 mm-hmm. or something, you know, mm-hmm. and I didn't want them leaving the home and thinking they could just use that word wherever they felt. But like, that's a totally fine word. I don't know why I reacted like that. We have different bodies, you know? So it is funny how that old programming pops up even when we're doing the work.
I'd love you to kind of bottom line it for us and also maybe just, you know, big vision it for us. So if all of us, or even just more of us, are freed from this diet culture, right? If we're able to just be outside of that. And so not so much of our energy is spent calculating calories and figuring out how much did I exercise and what did I eat, what didn't I eat, and not feeling shame around our food choices. If we're free of that, like what do you see? What is possible for us? What's the big vision you see?
I mean, to me, it's like, what could you do with like 15 extra hours a day? You know what I mean? Like what, what couldn't we do? I think that, you know, the reality is that just so much more peace and freedom and joy, honestly, so much more joy. That's what it's brought to my life. A much deeper sense of self. Like it's a real process of like getting to know yourself and like, not that it's done yet, but that idea of like authenticity and having, you know, it's not a super beautiful, inspirational path all the time. It's like quite bumpy, but at the end, there's just so much more freedom and peace and self-awareness. And yeah, I just feel like the possibilities are kind of infinite.
I would like to say most of our listeners are, you know, 40 plus, we have a few younger and whatever, but so a lot of us are moving into that perimenopause, menopause state. And so I'm wondering if you have any tips, because, you know, when I look back at a picture of myself when I was 25 years old, and then I think about myself now and I think, oh yeah, can I get back into that body? What, like, it's the reality is I will never be that body again. I'm 48 years old. I've had three pregnancies, right? I've given birth three times. Like my body should not actually be the same. And now my hormones are changing. So what kind of tips can you offer, or, you know, maybe some things that we should know about what actually happens to our bodies as we age?
Right. So the biggest thing that happens sort of between 40 and somewhere, you know, 55, sometimes a little bit later, is perimenopause, which can last like 10 years, sometimes even longer. And what's happening,
my husband that the other day, he asked, how long does this
last? He was like, what? and so our estrogen is on this slow decline. And at the same time, progesterone is like, yeah, it's like a bouncy ball. Right. And so we experience a lot of like interesting symptoms, but you know, weight gain around the middle is really common at this time, because it's as estrogen decreases in our body, you know, fat does produce estrogen. And so in a very weird way, it's like our body's attempt at maintaining a certain level of estrogen in the body, because estrogen is very heart protective and very bone protective. And so, you know, I joke, but it's not funny. It's true. It's like, it's not a spare tire. It's a life preserver. You know, it's the thing that's there to save you. And so is it hard to experience changes in your body? Yeah, it is. In the same way that it's hard to have an after baby body shift, or an after surgery body shift, or an after mental emotional crisis body shift. Like anytime our bodies change, whether it's because of physical reasons or just aging, or because anytime it changes, there's an adjustment that has to happen. So it's not that it's not hard, but if we could normalize it a little bit more, instead of it becoming another layer of proof that we as women don't have control of ourselves, it would make that process, that like that shift into perimenopause, a lot easier. And sometimes things do shift back once menopause actually hits, interestingly, but like, who knows? But we are most likely to end up in the body that is healthiest for us when we are working with our body. We are most likely statistically to see weight continue to go up when we're dieting our body over and over again. So, you know, weight is complicated, but sometimes that's the information women need to sort of cut their losses. But for me, I have a program, Redefining Health, and it's specifically for women in their midlife, because it's about, you know, it's about intuitive eating and it's about body acceptance, but it's about those things at a time in life where our body is shifting again. And we're going through this like second adolescence and everything feels very out of control. And diet and wellness culture wants to package up a diet and tell us it's this nifty, easy way to get control of our bodies. Mm-hmm. And instead it just tends to keep women on this like hamster wheel, on this roller coaster, at a time in their life when they should be enjoying their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A time in their life where they should be enjoying their lives, and or a time in their life when they have more demands on them than ever. Mm-hmm. Raising kids still, dealing with parents that are getting older. So there's that part of that period of time where we're already stretched to the max, and now you want me to diet and over-exercise my body. And then there's this other piece where like we start to move out of both of those things, and we should just be able to be enjoying, and we're still wrapped up in the body stuff. Mm-hmm. So how do we gently, how do we use nutrition and movement in a gentle way to support our bodies through this without like punishing ourselves and dieting our way through it in a way that feels bad.
One of the questions we like to ask our guests is, what would you say to your 15-year-old self? You had mentioned that 1920 was kind of a critical period for you. So you can use that age if you'd like, but looking back, what would you say to yourself now, if you had the opportunity, what would you say to your 19, 20-year-old self?
I think that it would be something along the lines, I'm going to botch it up, but it would be something along the lines of like, you can trust yourself. And so all those things that you are fighting in your nature are important, integral pieces of you. So nobody ever, even when I was recovering, nobody ever said that, you know, it was still like all the things that I was fighting were things that were broken in me. And I see now that those were all the things that were leading me to the things that are right for me, that are correct. And like, if I'm experiencing them, I'm sure other people have experienced them too. So that I think is such a big, you know, resisting diet culture requires that we're willing to trust ourselves and that our cravings and our instincts and our appetites and our desires are good for us, not all bad for us, you know?
I think one of the biggest message I'm getting you from you today is that, you know, our minds are going to go to the places where they think the things. And one of the things we have to remind ourselves is this dysfunctional thinking or thinking that we are broken or there is something wrong with us is constantly coming from external sources, that the trust and the idea and the acceptance and that we are okay is not what we learn. And that's part of what we need to grow within us. But any kind of sort of, you know, I'm broken or this isn't right, or I should be able to, or whatever, like that's somebody else's thought implanted in our brain. So I really appreciate you sharing that. And the other question we like to ask is, what is your afterglow? So your afterglow is what's next for you. It's what you envision for yourself and the world. And, you know, you already went from changing your sort of career path to focusing on this. And now you're really helping a lot of people, even in your new program with working with other practitioners to help them.
Yeah. And I think that's more and more, I think like I've done this for really like a long time now. And, in a really deep way, if that makes sense, because so much of this work can get watered down really easily and accidentally. And I feel like I just love helping practitioners and making sure that A, they really know how to break this down and break it apart for the people that are struggling still with weight and food and the negative health behaviors that come out of that whole roller coaster. But then I also love equipping people with the tools to move forward with health and wanting to have an interest in health and wellness without falling back down that hole. Cause I don't think that there are as many people who are doing that work. Right. And so I think that will continue to grow for me, I hope.
Beautiful. Yeah. And they need you, right? You're a bunch of little Davids against this huge Goliath industry. So
you forget that when you're in it, you forget it. And then every now and then you take a step out and it's like, whoa, I forgot. Yeah. This is still all here. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So, well, thank you for being here. I mean, it's truly inspiring the work that you're doing. And, you know, Julie and I, this is why we started the podcast, because we also share that same vision of a world where women are not always spending so much energy, you know, minimizing themselves or shaming themselves or whatever it is. And when all that energy is taken away, that 15 hours per day taken away from, you know, counting calories, what can we actually do and create, you know, who knows? It's a whole new world out there. So
yeah,
thank you for being here and sharing these very helpful and practical tips.
Oh, thank you guys. Thanks for having me.
And where can we find you on your Instagram or website?
So foodfreedombodylove.com is the website. Food Freedom Body Love is the Instagram feed. And that's also the podcast name that I have. And my newer programs are called Redefining Health, but they are part of the Food Freedom Body Love sort of model. They're just down the road a little bit from,
amazing.
You know, in the
work. I love that. Yeah. Food Freedom Body Love. Thank you so much, Jillian.
Thank you.
That's a wrap for this episode of The Afterglow. Yet another courageous Canadian sharing her vision.
Do us a favor and lift a sister up by sharing this podcast with others who want to find their afterglow. And let us know, what do you want to hear about? Who do you want to hear from? And what is your afterglow? Slide on into our DMs at The Afterglow Podcast Official
and leave us a message.
Did you love this podcast? Be sure to like and rate us on Spotify and iTunes and wherever you tune in. Until next time.
Thank you so much to the Riches Group for sponsoring this episode for us. We are so indebted to you and grateful for all you've done for our community as well. Not only are you a incredible real estate agency servicing the beaches and other areas in Toronto, but you are always giving back to the community in donations, in charity, in helping out. And so we are grateful for you and really proud to have your name on our podcast. If you're looking for The Riches Group, you can find them at theriches.ca.